This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Today's episode is about keeping workers safe during the coronavirus outbreak. And we're going to have two great experts with lots of experience in this area. And first, though, I want to mention this is the last episode of season 3, episode 7. Originally, a few episodes back, I had said that our last episode of the season would be one devoted to questions and answers, that is, questions from our listeners here, and then answers from me and some other guests that we might have. And we have decided to put that off until the next season. There are two reasons for that. One is the coronavirus outbreak, which we hadn't anticipated, and that gave way to a need, we thought, to deal with some issues in this season related to COVID-19. The other reason was, frankly, the questions that we were getting most of had to do with COVID-19. And so we devoted now three different episodes at the very end of our season to the coronavirus outbreak. And so this one obviously included. As you know, at CPR, we are all about connecting the dots between environment, safety, health, and issues directly related to that. We educate and advocate and collaborate as a think and do tank, as we say around here at Center for Progressive Reform, all in order so that we can help communities thrive on a resilient planet. And one of the reasons that we were so drawn right to the coronavirus outbreak, as basically all the news media is that we know that in times of national crises, you can see the weak and the strong aspects of your society in sharper relief. You see the underlying issues, the strengths and the weaknesses that you have. And this is a good time, despite all of the many, many challenges and tragic stories in the news. It's also a time to take a good look at what's going right and wrong in our response to the coronavirus outbreak. And that will tell you more about what's right and wrong about our state of government in general. And so, for instance, in episode 5 was titled Saving Government Expertise and Protecting the Public Health. And we used that episode to take a look at the coronavirus emergency in order to show how government has ignored and is continuing to ignore, in many ways, scientific and economic expertise. And that's something that's been going on for many years and that we might be able to address, right, if we understand how that's happening. Episode 6, One Doctor's Life in Time of Coronavirus, was an episode devoted again to coronavirus, but seeing it in the context of the healthcare system through the eyes of a single doctor, a geriatric doctor named Andrew Duxbury, who's in Alabama. And we had a wonderful discussion in which we were using the coronavirus outbreak to look at issues of distributional effects in hospital and medical care, effects that affect the elderly, the poor, and the LGBT community. And we also saw in that interview some bright spots. That is, you know, there's always been a lot of strength in community organizing related to issues of public health when the people get informed. There's a lot of positive stories of social bonding that have occurred in public health crises. And we're seeing that kind of social bonding and that kind of unification and spiritedness in many communities surrounding the coronavirus outbreak. And so that's another wonderful interview that will bring us, I think, good information about not just what to do in times of crisis like this, but how we might imagine a healthcare system that will be stronger and more robust in the future. So that brings us to today, where we are going to be looking at keeping workers safe during the time of coronavirus. I'm talking about all the healthcare providers, the letter carriers, the meat packer who chopped the chicken that you cooked last night, the woman who drives the streetcar through my neighborhood in New Orleans. To help us work through these issues are two great legal experts with lots of experience in many fields. Both are member scholars at CPR. The first is Tom McGarrity. He's a professor of law at the University of Texas, Austin. He's been on our show before. He's advocated for over 25 years on issues of occupational safety, food safety, and other issues. And Michael Duff, who is a professor of law at the University of Wyoming. He also is a member scholar at CPR. He just joined us recently. He's an expert in labor relations. And before entering law school and becoming a legal scholar, he served with the Teamsters as a blue-collar worker for 15 years. He was a shop steward and a union organizer for much of that time. I caught up with Tom McGarrity and Michael Duff on April 30th on a web conference line. Here's the interview. Tom McGarrity and Michael Duff, thanks for being on Connect the Dots. I've got a question for you both. You have been working on a report for the Center for Progressive Reform on issues of worker safety in the era of the COVID-19 outbreak. And I know that in drafts of your report, you have used a particular story of the death of Annie Grant to illustrate the importance of some of these worker safety issues during COVID-19. Tom, would you tell us that story about Annie Grant and explain its wider significance to worker safety issues in the time of the coronavirus outbreak?
Sure. Well, Annie Grant had worked on a packing line at the Tyson's Foods poultry processing plant in Camilla, Georgia. She'd worked there for 15 years, but one morning in late March, she woke up and felt feverish. Two of her 13 children urged her to stay home rather than work in a chilled line with a fever, but she told them that the company insisted that she continue to work. The company was short on help, and supplies of stored chicken were running low as people around the country hoarded it as they headed into a period of sheltering in place. Vice President Pence told food supply workers that the nation needed them, and I quote, to continue as part of what we call critical infrastructure, to show up and do your job. So she did. Tyson's, in fact, was offering a $500 bonus to employees if they worked for 3 months without missing a day. She showed up. She labored there shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of other workers, slicing thousands of chicken carcasses a day. But she had to return home when she became too ill to work. She then checked herself into a hospital where she later died of a COVID-19 infection. Two of her co-workers died of the same disease within the next few days. One of Annie's sons believed that had the plant management taken proper precautions, they would have prevented people from getting that disease. Tyson's later implemented social distancing measures, installed dividers between the stations, slowed production lines, and took employee temperatures before allowing them into the plant. But that was too late for Annie. Annie was in the position of millions of workers around the United States who really didn't have the option of sheltering in place and telecommuting. They were essential workers, or in many cases, they simply feared they'd lose their jobs if they didn't show up for work.
That's a very powerful story. And I want to get into the issues in particular about meat processing a little bit later in our interview. But I'm wondering, Mike, if you can tell us, give us a little bit of an idea of what many of these essential workers are facing. Tom's told us a little bit about what it's like being in a meat processing plant. And the truth is that while many of us, as Tom says, are sheltering in place, there are many, many of us in our communities that are medical workers, delivery workers, grocery store clerks, the list goes on. What sorts of risks are these folks facing? In particular, risks that we might not think about because many of us, you know, don't have experience in jobs like these.
Yeah, well, I do. I have experience in jobs like those. I was a blue-collar worker for 15 years before I went to law school. And one of the things that I think is difficult to get at from a distance is a sense of pace, that people are moving fast, the sense of not having as much control of your body as you might think. You know, people are bumping into you. There's a lot of jostling going on. You're picking up objects. Things are getting dropped. People are breathing on you. And the other thing is that this idea, this kind of myth of job engineering, you know, that yes, it is true that you can put up a piece of plexiglass between, you know, a customer and a cashier. But the reality is that all kinds of things in a normal workday are happening at close quarters in ways that maybe you don't even anticipate. So the engineering only goes so far. You're brushing up against people. You're breathing on people. You're without realizing it. You know, maybe you're eating in the workplace or somebody else is eating in the workplace. And so there are all kinds of ways that you could be coming in close contact with other human beings, many of which you simply don't have control over.
We have to include customers and members of the public, too. I know, Tom, you've made this point in your writing. At the very least, an employer can control, I guess, in theory, what other employees do. But how do you control sort of what the customers in the grocery store are going to do, or in the pet store, or you know, whatever the facility is?
That's exactly right. There are lots of situations in which the employer doesn't control the environment. A meatpacking plant, there's a fair amount of control, though even there, as Mike suggests, pieces of chicken fall on the ground, and there's actually in one of these plants, there's someone whose job it is to go pick up all the pieces of chicken and put them back on the line.
Oh,
well, that person's coming into contact with lots of other people. But in a retail setting or a delivery setting, think about the postal service, think about the other delivery services, it's much more difficult to separate the employee from some other person who may have contracted the COVID-19 disease and be shedding it, but not even aware that they have it.
I mean, you know, I was actually just talking to my sister about this yesterday. She's a nurse. She's been a nurse for 20 years in Carson City, Nevada. And I've just written a piece that's on a CPR blog about the availability of these N95 respirators, these face masks. And she wrote me back and we started talking. She says that she used to use these N95 masks one time only, right when you're in contact with one patient, because she's trying to protect the patient from anything she's been exposed to, but she also could be exposed to whatever a patient has, because of course they're working very closely, and you know, patients can sneeze and cough and all kinds of things. But now she's told that she gets one N95 mask. She has to wear it multiple times with multiple patients, and then she only turns it in if it is visibly soiled. And at that point, she turns it in and they sterilize it and then they give it back to her again. It just seems in a way, and I guess I'll ask you, but I've just started to think about this. So let me ask you a little bit about this. You know, in a way, we have as a culture, we're drawn to these stories. In some ways, it almost seem heroic, particularly healthcare workers who obviously have their lives on the line, and many others, as you point out. And we're very grateful, I think, as a society, that people are willing to put themselves in these kinds of circumstances. But at the same time, I can't stop thinking that they actually, many of them anyway, don't have a lot of choice in the matter. I mean, it's not like the chicken processor is saying, I'm going to put my life on the line for my country. It's the chicken processor who's saying, I really don't have much of a choice in all of this, whether I want to go to work or not.
I think you're absolutely right. You really don't have that choice, because if you don't go to work, you're going to get fired. Some employers in the meatpacking industry told their employees, well, you can take indefinite leave of absence without pay up until May 1st. But that's all gone away now, as tomorrow is May 1st, and they're expected back on the job now.
Tom, I want to ask you a little bit about, I want to talk about some systems that are designed to help workers in unsafe workplaces. And the first one I want to start out with is something that I'm sure a lot of people have heard, OSHA, which stands for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It's an agency within the Department of Labor. And OSHA implements and enforces, in particular, a statute that's also called OSHA, which stands for the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. You write and you teach about OSHA. How does OSHA, the act and the agency, relate to worker safety issues regarding infection, particularly during the COVID-19 situation?
Well, let me start from the beginning, kind of. In 1970, Congress enacted the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and it provided two basic kinds of protections. One, it empowered the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, to promulgate health and safety standards. And these standards were to protect workers in the workplace. So it might be a number, no more than 3 parts per million of vinyl chloride in the air for a health standard. Or it could be more prescriptive and saying, when you have an implement that could slice somebody's hand off, you put a tag on it, things like that. In the context of infectious diseases, OSHA in the Obama administration was considering one of these standards for pathogen protection. It was considering in the context of health workers in hospitals and such as that. And it had gotten fairly far along the way of promulgating one of these standards, or at least proposing one, when we had the election and the Trump administration came in. The Trump administration immediately put it on the back burner. And I think as of the first of this year, it wasn't even on the burner at all. So that's one way you could go about protecting workers. But there's a broader way, and it's something called...
Tom, let me interrupt, though. Are you saying now that there is no OSHA standard at all having to do with infectious exposure?
That's what I'm saying, yes. We do not have a pathogen protection standard in place.
Okay, and you wanted to make a larger point, so go ahead.
Well, a more general point, if you will. In addition to the standard setting process, which can take years, it's turned into a very difficult process to promulgate a full-fledged OSHA standard for a number of reasons that probably we don't have time to go into today, but having to do with judicial review and requiring large records and trial type hearings and that sort of thing. Lots and lots of evidence. So these are difficult to do. You really have to prepare hard to do it, but it's certainly doable. You can promulgate an emergency temporary standard to deal with an emergency. Perhaps in a minute we can come back and talk about the petitions to OSHA to do that.
Sure.
But I want to talk about the general duty that an employer has to provide a safe workplace for its workers. And this is called the general duty clause. And that is apart from any particular standard. It simply is a duty to protect workers from the kinds of risks that could result in serious injury or death to the employees. And that's also applicable, obviously, in the case of a disease or a pathogen that could and does kill people. So there's the possibility of simply going into the workplace for an OSHA inspector and looking to see if they are complying with the general duty clause and making a case that, well, you haven't. Okay. Now, OSHA also has a power to require employers to report workplace diseases and workplace injuries. And here one would think, well, then the employers ought to be reporting incidences of COVID-19 infections. And here the Trump administration has said, yes, you do have that duty to report infections of COVID-19 in the healthcare industry. Otherwise, though, you needn't report it because you can't be sure it arose in the workplace unless there is some objective evidence that it did, that the employee did contract the disease in the workplace. So we're not even getting good reports, which you need really to form the basis for one of these standards.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, because the whole idea of an infection is that it happens gradually and visibly, and you don't necessarily know where the exposure occurred, I suppose.
Well, that's true. Although I think in the case of a workplace like a slaughterhouse, where you see lots and lots of people, you see it turn into a hot spot, that you can pretty much assume that most of them are at least create a rebuttable presumption that the exposures occurred in the workplace.
Right. I mean, particularly when people are falling ill at the same time. You had said that there was a process in which workers could petition OSHA. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. A worker or a union can petition OSHA to promulgate an emergency temporary standard for a particularly dangerous situation that needs to be addressed immediately. And several entities, including the AFL-CIO, have in fact petitioned OSHA to promulgate an emergency temporary standard. And OSHA says, no, we think we can deal with this easily enough with just enforcing the general duty clause.
Mike, you have you're a former union member. I know you were in the Teamsters. Can you tell us a little bit about the success, or tell us about the process, I guess, by which a union might decide to raise a petition like this, and what kind of success they normally have?
Well, I think that unions would be, you know, very immediately concerned about the right now situation concerning their membership. So I'm sure they're thinking about petitioning. And I also know that a number of unions have collective bargaining agreements that contain health and safety provisions. And so there would be the potential for filing a grievance, invoking the protections of the collective bargaining agreement, that can take time. And frankly, Tom, you know, it's interesting. It occurred to me, you know, when you think about the concept of general duty, my suspicion is that a number of our listeners might think it sounds somewhat crazy. You know, how could an employer not have a duty to maintain a safe workplace? And I think I'm an old tort workers' comp guy in addition to my union background. And so, you know, it's interesting how this question of duty and, you know, when you have a duty and when you don't have a duty and whether that duty's coming from, OSHA, the OSHA statute or where it's coming from is fundamentally important, you know, because either an employer has a duty to do something or it doesn't. And I think that, you know, from a union perspective, you know, those collective bargaining agreements are put together with the expectation that parties are going to be able to quickly discuss dangerous situations, and everybody's kind of going to know when you have a dangerous situation,
right?
Or you don't. But I think the model is that you would have you'd have a grievance filed, and then the grievances would be processed through certain procedures under the collective bargaining agreement. And at the end of the day, if you couldn't agree, you'd have an arbitration. And this sort of points to a problem that we're having in whatever legal regime we're sort of discussing, is that much of it is retrospective. It's you know, the situation is happening now. And so if we get an arbitration in 4 months or 6 months or a year, maybe the union ultimately will win that arbitration, but it doesn't necessarily do a lot to address the issue at hand right now, which is that adequate safety measures aren't being taken. And we want to know what we can do about it right now.
Well, so let me ask you this, Mike. Tom said earlier that, well, if you got a worker who feels that she's going into an unsafe work environment, whether it's meat processing or a warehouse, whatever it is, that person, you know, can get fired if the person doesn't show up for work. And Trump, just a couple of days ago, today that we're recording this interview is April 30th, and on April 28th, Trump issued an executive order saying, essentially requiring meat processing plants to stay open amid the pandemic. The order classifies meat processing as a critical infrastructure, as part of critical infrastructure. And of course, the unions oppose that. Can you tell me a little bit, Mike, what is the consequence of a move like that? Does that mean that meat processors are going to have to go to work because the president says so, or how does that unfold?
Well, I think the honest answer at the moment is nobody knows. But I do think there's a big difference between saying that the meatpacking facility must be open and preventing a state from closing it, let's say, and telling workers that they must go to work. Now, as we all know, workers often have to go to work. They don't, as Tom was saying, they don't really have a choice. But it seems to me that any order that would purport to tell somebody that they have to go to work treads perilously on the knife edge of the 13th Amendment. I don't want to get all that grandiose, but the idea that government is going to tell me that I must go to work at any time seems more than a little problematic. That sounds like involuntary servitude, and I'm probably being a little colorful here, but I don't know that I'm being all that colorful, because that's certainly what it feels like when somebody says that to me.
Actually, I had a conversation with a constitutional lawyer yesterday who mentioned the 13th Amendment in this context, the 13th Amendment being the amendment that ended slavery in the United States, and it, as you point out, forbids involuntary servitude, whether on the part of the state or on the part of private parties.
There's another alternative that I think if the workers just didn't show up, the president would have the alternative of sending in the army to do it,
right,
or
right,
perhaps the National Guard. And that may, which would be really an interesting thing to see these soldiers in this workplace trying to
make
to see chop them up chopping the chicken.
It will have other kinds of injury problems.
Do we have?
Yes, indeed.
Do we have precedent for that?
There's precedent for the president invoking his emergency power to send the to send federal troops places. Sure,
coal mines.
Yeah,
interesting. So what about, I also was in a conversation yesterday with a lawyer who mentioned the Taft-Hartley Act, saying that this is an act that that allows, if I've got it right, the president to force workers to work when they are striking, assuming that the work that they're doing is declared of a particular type of national importance.
Can I take a whack at that?
Yes, please do.
All right. So there is a provision under the National Labor Relations Act, Section 502 of the LMRA, that basically says that if you refuse to do ultra-hazardous work, then your refusal is not deemed to be a strike. Okay? It's not a strike. That's what it actually says. It's not right conferring in itself. It just says it's not deemed a strike. Why is that important? It's important because a number of collective bargaining agreements have no strike provisions. And so if unionized workers or the union as an entity say, well, we're going on strike, notwithstanding the no strike pledge that we've taken in the collective bargaining agreement, there can be an injunction issue to compel the union and the bargaining unit employees to go back to work. Right now, the president has authority under Taft-Hartley in certain situations to compel unions to comply with their collective bargaining agreement. So it's much more tied up in the landscape of collective bargaining. Existing collective bargaining agreements and obligations that that unions have under collective bargaining agreements. And I want to make a distinction here between, unionized work stoppages and work stoppages involving non-union employees who engage in concerted activities, right? We've seen a number of these COVID-19 actions, both in unionized and non-union environments. And it's sometimes thought that striking employees in that situation, that their work stoppage, which is what it is, must be objectively reasonable. But outside of the context of union workplaces operating under collective bargaining agreements where there is a no strike pledge, Section 502 and objectively reasonable has no application. What we're dealing with is another provision of the labor law that protects concerted activity of employees generally. And so I've seen a number of accounts of these concerted work actions, and I think a number of them are protected. And in fact, when I was back when I worked at the NLRB a million years ago, we handled a number of cases in which there were concerted actions with no union present. And the only question is whether that action was taken in good faith. It didn't have to be reasonable, might have been unreasonable. And as long as it was taken in good faith, it was protected activity. And frankly, I don't see how any work stoppage that's happening because of this fear of exposure to COVID-19 could not be taken in good faith. In fact, I'll bet most of them are pretty reasonable.
Okay, let's take a break. As I mentioned, we at CPR have been putting our full resources toward understanding the coronavirus outbreak. And if you check out our website, www.progressivereform.org, you will find a banner right at the top that says COVID-19. And if you click that, you'll see all the different products, all the different materials that we are coming up with on that issue. And it's continuing to grow. Right now, you'll see lots of blog posts on a variety of issues, some which will become longer reports as we continue to work on this. You'll see some news about podcasts, some news about webinars, and lots of topics that you're probably interested in at this point, involving the connection between COVID-19 and pollution, the relationship between COVID and food insecurity, and also, of course, what all of this has to do with the climate crisis. And believe me, there are connections. So take a look at that, www.progressivereform.org. All right, let's get back to the interview. I want to move to workers' compensation, which is another system that we have in the United States to protect workers in certain situations. So Tom was telling us about OSHA, which is mainly a federal system, although there are, in many cases, state agencies that implement many of the OSHA standards. The workers' compensation system, that's I guess you'd call it a special insurance system for workers that's available in all 50 states, but that's governed by an individual state's law. Mike, I'm going to ask you this because I know that you write and teach in this area quite a bit. Can you just tell us a little bit about some of the special pressure points you think exist in the workers' comp system related to COVID-19? What keeps you up at night when you think about what kind of novel issues might be coming up?
Lots of things keep me up at night. But the first thing I would like to start out with is that, you know, we've been talking about duty, right? And as I said, I'm an old torts teacher. And, you know, ordinarily people might look at this and think, you know, wait a minute, you sent workers into an environment that you knew was dangerous, or at least, and maybe you didn't intend for them to be hurt, but you were pretty careless when you sent those workers in. Anybody that's been to law school, and even people who haven't been to law school, might start thinking, well, that sounds like some kind of a tort suit.
Yeah.
And the reason it's not a tort suit or a negligence suit is because workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy that employees have for physical injury in most workplaces. Okay. And that's because of a deal, of a grand bargain that was made at the turn of the 20th century, wherein employees gave up their right to sue in tort in exchange for a benefit that consists of an indemnity benefit, some percentage of the wage that they were making at the time of their injury, and reimbursement for medical benefits or payment for medical.
So they don't have to take the risk of going to court and winning.
Take the risk of going to court. They don't have to prove negligence. They don't have to get into this question about whether the employer acted recklessly. But what they do have to prove is causation. And that's the problem here. The problem is, generally speaking, workers' compensation statutes cover employees whose workplaces increase the risk of a particular kind of injury or illness occurring. And the problem here is that it can be very difficult to show that the workplace increased the risk of sustaining the illness, say, beyond the background risk that the general public is exposed to. Now, as Tom points out, and I think this is quite true, it's pretty hard to argue that a meatpacking plant wouldn't increase the risk of contracting the disease. But suffice to say that it can be difficult to prove causation, and it's for that, and that's the real sticking point, and it's for that reason that there are a handful of states that have passed what are called COVID-19 workers' compensation presumptions. And maybe you've seen some of this in the news. And basically what these presumptions do is they say, hey, if you're a certain category of worker and it's confirmed that you're suffering from COVID-19, we're simply going to presume that you contracted the disease in the course of your employment. Your employment caused the disease. Now, these are rebuttable presumptions. Usually, I think Alaska has an irrebuttable presumption, but usually they're rebuttable. And the idea is that once the employee is establish the rebuttable presumption, the burden shifts to the employer to show that, in fact, COVID-19 was not caused by the workplace. And I think you can tell that might be as hard to prove as it is for the employee to prove that it was caused by the workplace. So the sticking point, Rob, to answer your question, is really causation. It's all about causation.
Right. Now, Tom, you teach torts too, I know. And I guess I'm wondering, would there in some cases be an advantage to being able to bring a tort suit rather than having to go through the workers' comp process?
Well, it's rarely an advantage to the worker.
Okay.
Because there are defenses available in a negligence case that aren't available in a workers' comp case, like contributory negligence or the fellow servant rule, it's called. It wasn't the employer that did it, it was a fellow servant, or assumption of the risk. And that's the one that really...
Unholy trinity.
Exactly. The unholy trinity of defenses. So it's difficult for workers. Now, Texas, interestingly, I think it's maybe the only state that gives the employer the option of electing into one or the other systems. And most employers elect to go into the workers' comp system. Let's don't limit ourselves just to workers. What about their families? What about the members of the community out there when they bring the COVID-19 home and their families get infected, or our people in the community get infected? Now we're talking about a different kind of suit. And there's one case that's been brought at this point against, I think it's a JBS plant in Missouri, that's right. A public nuisance claim that you've used your property in a way that endangers the community. And the classic public nuisance case was someone who allowed vermin and mosquitoes on their property and to congregate there, and then they go off the property and they cause disease. And the classic remedy for a nuisance is abatement, which is shut it down, or at the very least make the landowner install the best available technology to reduce the risks posed by that public nuisance.
And if I'm understanding you right, that means that the harm wouldn't be that I necessarily, if I live in that community, have to show that I got COVID because of workers at the plant, but I could say that my risk of being exposed to COVID has increased as a result.
That's exactly right. That the risk to the community as a whole,
right.
An individual plaintiff may have to establish standing and have to show some peculiar harm to that individual, but a public nuisance case can also be brought by a representative of the community, say the mayor of a nearby city. Then standing is not nearly is not much of an issue.
This raises, the idea that we've got certain communities, right, that have certain kinds of plants or certain kinds of warehouses, or in my neck of the woods down here around New Orleans, the petrochemical industry, many of the facilities that are manufacturing plastics and so on are still operating. They're designated as essential uses. This raises for me an issue about distribution of harms, right? Because we know that there's a racial aspect to this. There's a class aspect. As you point out in your report, there's a gender aspect too, of people who, because of segregation in the marketplace, people whose jobs are more likely to require them to be public facing in this time. Does either one of you want to take on that for a moment and just sort of explain what the social justice issues are in all of this that we're talking about?
It is interesting how it connects so well to discussions of environmental racism, understanding where production facilities are located, who is disparately impacted by something going wrong in the plant, and I think it raises all of those issues. And in fact, I mean, one of the interesting things, I think we wanted to talk about the recent Trump order.
Yes.
Pertaining to, we talked about a little bit, the reopening of the meat facilities. I think one of the thinking seems to be there's some background thinking that this may work to broadly immunize these facilities, from liability. But I think what may be driving this and what may be driving all the sort of discussions about liability in the context of the reopening is that, we do see so many harms distributed in the ways that we're talking about, harms to the community, harms to the individual worker, the disparate impact of harms. I saw a reference to, trial attorneys sharpening their pencils. I was amused because I'd like to know who's using pencils in this day and age. But, I think the in back of all of that is the recognition by almost everybody that there are theories of liability. They exist, or you wouldn't have such a clamor for this very broad immunization. But those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I would add to that. There are workplaces where it's clearly what you have is a disproportionate impact. Think about field workers who are out there working in the fields and picking tomatoes. It's hard to socially distance there. And even if you could, these migrant workers live in trailers or in dorms that the employers have put together for them. So the possibility of infection is just is clearly high. Now, as to the liability issue, before President Trump signed this executive order declaring the meatpacking facilities to be critical infrastructure, he wasn't talking about critical infrastructure. He said the Tysons and the other meatpackers had a liability problem.
Oh, tell me about that. That's interesting.
And we're going to solve this liability problem, he said. Well, the liability problem, I think, is this nuisance suit that I was talking about. It was one where the company said, oh, my gosh, we could get sued by these communities. And they may well have even been thinking about workers' compensation, which when you think about it, would be flabbergasting if by declaring this public emergency and then declaring that the meatpacking industry is essential and that workers have to work in the meat plants but not claim workers' compensation or to take away that claim would be unprecedented. Now, I don't think that the law will allow him to go that far. They have not suggested this. I think this is something that's germinating or is being discussed in the Justice Department. It would be by way of a defense that the company would raise when that to that nuisance claim or conceivably to a workers' compensation claim. And the situation is that the law is very unclear on this. There's been one case where the defendant said that the Defense Production Act, that's this act that the White House has invoked here, that this Defense Production Act would protect a defendant from tort liability. And that's the classic Agent Orange case that Judge Feinstein decided way back in 1986. But there he rejected that and said that the provision in the Defense Production Act that waives liability applied only to liability that a company who had contracted with another company to supply goods would incur when the government says, no, those goods have to come in the direction we're going to direct them, and that company gets sued by the company that didn't get the goods. And Judge Weinstein said that's the only situation in which this waiver and the Defense Production Act is applicable. The Supreme, yes, it's in a contract case. Judge Weinstein then, in this tort case, where the soldiers that were damaged in Vietnam by Agent Orange were suing the manufacturers of the Agent Orange, Judge Weinstein said, that's not applicable here.
Interesting. So you think that this might be a theory that's being cooked up in the White House, but that ultimately it would fail?
Well, what worries me is that in this opinion, Judge Weinstein threw out one sentence that concerns me. And he said that it's possible to hypothesize tort cases where a causal connection could be found, for example, where the government order forced the contractor to begin production before it was fully ready to or at a quicker pace than it would have to be done otherwise, resulting in injury to an employee that might otherwise be covered by the waiver, he says. That worries me a little bit because that sounds...
It worries me too. Yeah. but I will say that the reason that there are so few cases is that when you think of the context of the invocation of that act, you're typically not talking about this kind of national emergency, right? And you've got it gets kind of conflated with the military contractor defense. That gets kind of out in the weeds, but it is, I would agree that the law is unclear here, but a lot of what the judge had to say before he got to that line that I agree is troubling, resonated with me in terms of, if this was really an act that intended to intrude on an area like tort law, because there are, you know, some obvious federalism issues here, then Congress would have been a lot clearer about saying that. So I think the other way that I look at it, it's significant that we don't have any cases in which workers' compensation claims, for example, were eclipsed through operation of the statute.
And I would add one more point. I definitely agree with Mike on this. And the other point I would add is this came up again in the Supreme Court in another Agent Orange case, where a company sued the federal government claiming that it should be indemnified for all the damages it had paid out to the Vietnam veterans. And the court held that, no, this waiver in the Defense Production Act doesn't mention indemnification at all. It simply mentions immunity from a lawsuit. And then in a footnote, the court noted that the Clinton administration's Justice Department urged the court to hold that the Defense Production Act only barred liability to customers in contract situations. And the court said, we don't have to decide that question. But it is interesting that the only time we have an administration on record on this issue that I'm aware of, it's the administration agreeing with Judge Weinstein that this doesn't apply to tort actions.
Interesting. We have a few minutes left, and I want to take the opportunity to find out what's going on in various parts of the country where we're all located. So, Mike, you're in Wyoming. Tom, you're in Texas. I'm in Louisiana. Mike, is there a particular issue in your neck of the woods that you're following that you think bears some national attention?
Well, I do think that the Wyoming legislature has just begun to wrestle with the idea of a COVID-19 workers' compensation presumption. This is a very small economy, and Wyoming, interestingly, is what's known as a monopolistic state, which means that the state is the insurer of workers' compensation. We don't have private insurance carriers. And so that creates a set of problems, but it also can create opportunities in that the state government is in a position to essentially do what it thinks is best without, dealing with an organized insurance lobby. But I think this is such a small economy, there's such a sparse population that it may be one of the few times where there's an advantage to that kind of population sparseness. Although the medical infrastructure here is also very small. So I think with a lot of small states, one of the big concerns is, what would happen if we did have a widespread a more widespread outbreak, because there just aren't enough beds. But that's a broader COVID-19 problem in the workplace. I think, generally speaking, everything has slowed down. Nothing has really reopened at this point, and there is that workers' compensation issue I mentioned.
I hear your wonderful dogs in the background. Wyoming dogs are not used to sheltering in place, I wouldn't think.
I warned you.
Tom, what's going on in Texas that you're following?
Well, in Texas, of course, we've got lots of meatpacking plants. So that's where, not surprisingly, our hotspots are, at least on a per capita basis. It's around the meatpacking plants. We still have not really seen the numbers coming down in terms of people contracting COVID-19 in Texas. But our governor has been very anxious to get the economy back moving again, given that the oil industry has gone kaput. So he has, as of tomorrow, theaters are going to be open, restaurants can open, various other venues will be available. But at only 25% capacity. And then if we have a couple of weeks where we don't have a spike in the numbers, then it'll go up to 50% capacity. That's probably moving a little too rapidly for my thinking, because we really haven't seen the numbers head down, and we certainly haven't had 2 weeks where they've been going in a downward direction. What we're seeing is these hotspots popping up in very rural places, where, again, we don't have good hospitals or even any hospitals at all. Now, one interesting little point I'll make is the one county in Texas for a time was the hottest spot in the entire country was Donley County. And it was because the county judge, that's the elected official that is the chief executive for the county, was also a doctor. And he was able to get testing so that they tested lots and lots of people.
Wow.
Well, it turns out that there was COVID-19 in this. The county has a total population of under 5,000, but a surprising proportion of them had COVID-19. What it suggests is there's no meat plant there. What it suggests is that probably the incidence of COVID-19 is a lot larger once you really do test a lot for it.
All right.
Well, and I'll just mention in Louisiana, as far as the shelter-in-place orders go, as far as I know, and this is April 30, we're being told that these shelter-in-place orders are going to be going through mid-May, but our Democratic governor is getting a lot of pushback from Republicans in the legislature. One of the things that I track here in New Orleans, which is just downriver from so-called Cancer Alley, the area where we have so many petrochemical plants, surrounded by poor African-American communities. One of the things that we're seeing first is that there's an extraordinary racialized impact on COVID-19 of the deaths in Louisiana. I think African Americans make up something like 60 to 70% of all the deaths, even though in the state of Louisiana, African Americans make up only about 30% of the population. Some of this has to do with comorbidities, but a lot of it, I think the main driver, what people are saying, has to do with the sort of work that they do. And apparently only 20% of African Americans, I think, in the United States are able to work at home in the jobs that they have. The other issue I'll just mention that we have is, as you know, a lot of these communities in Cancer Alley are heavily polluted. And we've recently seen studies, one coming out of the Harvard Public Health School, showing a connection between the exposure to soot over many years, which is an air pollutant, and COVID-19 deaths. And so there's been a lot of concern about that in Louisiana because some of these communities, St. John Parish being one, St. James being another, have very high cancer rates, in some cases the highest cancer rates in the country for certain kinds of exposures. And they also have very, very high COVID-19 fatality rates. And so that's something that people locally are keeping track of. This is just fascinating to see how the issues of work, the issues of social justice, how these things overlap. And I think in particular, what you've helped us with so much today is understanding how this this web of law, whether it's state law having to do with worker compensation and tort, or whether it's federal law having to do with OSHA and national standards for workplace safety, how all of these things intertwine. And when the safety net is frayed in good times, we see the stress in particular in bad times, right? So I just want to thank you very much, Michael Duff and Tom McGarrity, for joining me on Connect the Dots. And I want to wish you the best as we are in this crisis, and ask you to stay safe and keep well. And Mike, I hope you let those dogs out sometime soon.
I'll let them out. Who let the dogs out?
Thanks so much.
You're certainly welcome.
Well, that's our show and the end of Season 3. Look for Season 4 in September of 2020. In the meantime, you can like us on your app and subscribe and tell your friends about us on social media. Catch up with older episodes that are on our show page. You can find our show page at www.progressivereform.org, and you'll get more information about my guests today and the topics we discussed, as well as topics and guests from previous episodes. You can follow me on Twitter at Rob Virchik. Thanks again to the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, and to Brian Gum, assistant producer at CPR, who helps keep us cooking. Our music today was performed by Kitchen Romance, and our theme music, as always, by Lobo Loco. Be safe and take care of one another.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.